genres that clash and spill over. Disrupted times need disruptive formats. Frogs on the airwaves. Mistakes. Playlists that no algorithm will ever recommend. And I know weirdness can make us uncomfortable, but discomfort isn't a failure. I believe that it's a signal. It means that something alive is trying to break through. Strangeness isn't the enemy of truth. It's the way that truth sneaks in sideways. It says, you don't have to sound like me, and please don't sound like me. Just sound like you. Because in the end, it's not the content, it's the contact. It's not the reach, it's the resonance. It's not the polish, it's the possibility. So if I can offer you anything tonight, after all this, it's this. Keep being strange. Take that permission slip to the end of the world. Let your show be too much. Let your voice shake. Let your playlist get so weird. So weird. Let the silence stretch for longer than you know it should. Let the stranger in. Because they're you. They're us. They're why we built this signal in the first place. So may your weird be welcome. May your frequency stay just a little fuzzy. May you make space for what makes no sense, but feels absolutely right in your bones. May you never sound like another. And may your mistakes become the most beloved part of the archive. Because strange times, they don't just tolerate strangeness. They demand it. Thank you. I'll be listening.
Okay, we're getting towards the end of this little radio feature now, and I'm so glad that I was able to include some of Robin's inspiring and pertinent words. The last little snippet that I have for you is from an interview with the executive director of the NCRA, Barry Rook. But before we hear that, I'd just like to give a few shout-outs to some folks. You see, NCRA is the organization behind this conference, but proper due must also be given to that year's host station, CHLY in Nanaimo. They did such a great job in organizing extracurricular events and creating a fun and engaging atmosphere. So shout out to station manager Jesse Woodward and all of the CHLY volunteers for all of their hard work and their inclusive attitude. Big shout out also to CHLY host Joe Pugh for letting me camp out in his driveway and to Connor, the coordinator, for giving me a local's view of his city. So, back to Barry. Being the executive director of the NCRA, Barry was obviously at the top of this conference, but he felt more like a camp dad, really, than a big boss, and he's clearly passionate about community radio. Here he is on the morning after the awards show at the downtown library for the very last workshop and subsequent NCRA board meeting.
As a newly participating, very small station, I walk out of this feeling that I've been very much included and the NCRA been constantly fielding questions on inputs, what can you guys be doing better, and so on. So I feel like much more than just a celebration, you are actively trying to encourage people to create more work for you. What are some of the takeaways from this conference, do you think? What will you be working on in the next year?
Yeah, and exactly as you said, the amount of information that we get from the members' interactions allows us to move forward with what some of those ideas are. And we're just like you as a radio station. Our goal is to reflect the community and support the community back. Our community happens to be radio stations. Your community happens to be the community at large and your listeners. So we're just trying to sort of view the same way in what the work that you're doing. And what that's told us is that there's interest in collaboration and promotion of the industry and growing and developing the sector as a whole, trying to find ways in which we can help to better make discoverable content and what that our members are making. So there's a number of these areas that having a chance to sit down and chat with people doing our Birds of a Feather, where there was group discussions around key ideas and goals, codes of conduct and whatnot. Those are all areas that now both were often on the radar, but now we have a better understanding of priority and wants and needs. And, you know, it makes our job a lot easier to do, because all we want to do is find out what you need help with and then help you. So
We had a really great presentation by John from Australia. He's your equivalent, so to speak, in Australia. And that was really inspiring. He was the opening keynote. And after that, we heard from the CRFC and from other organizations involved. And I feel like despite all the challenges that media are facing generally, it feels like local radio stations, community radio stations at campus are on the up and up. And it seems like more funding is coming in, or at least there's really a hopeful feeling there. Is that your sense as well?
Yeah, there's a number of things that are on the horizon that have either been promised or we're expecting to finalize through court systems and whatnot. So there's some really positive things. There's core funding from the CRTC and the broadcasting updates. The local journalism initiative just got renewed for journalists in desert areas. The Canadian Journalist Coalition, who distributes Google funding, has money coming out. There's still lots of problems with that process, but it means that we're able to go forward. There's advertising opportunities. The Radio Fund's got new grants coming out. So there's a lot of those momentums and opportunities. And I'm also seeing that with the number of people who are interested and involved. I've got a dozen plus radio stations or want to be radio stations going forward. That number is growing. It's not growing in anywhere else in the sector. And we'll have a new national report out about listening numbers and interest. I would be dramatically surprised if that has not increased again by a large amount, because we're the only ones that are creating content that's live, that's local, that is relevant to the community that we're servicing. No offense to the commercial broadcasters or the CBC. You do your thing, that's great. People are looking for what we're doing. So that's why it's so important that the stations do get that funding.
Okay, thank you so much, Barry. I'm going to let you go and grab some lunch while you're getting ready for the rest of the board meeting. And I want to say on behalf of my own station and everybody I'm sure involved in the conference, thank you so much for your friendliness, your approachability, and not least all the hard work.
Oh, happy to, and I hope we get to see you soon. Next year, we're going to be in Toronto in the big city. So we'll get to see that. Hopefully you'll make that trip and join us.
I will do my best. Thank you.
I'd love to hear if you put everything together.
There were more than 30 sessions hosted at this conference, and I can't possibly cram all of my impressions into this feature, but I do want to express my gratitude to everybody there for making a radio rookie like me feel so very welcome. You gave me an appetite for getting deeper into community radio, and you inspired me on so many levels for my own radio productions. In the months that has followed, I have consulted my notes from the conference many times in my work as a member of the board of directors of my local station, CHFR. And it's made me feel like I almost know what I'm doing. It even gave me the confidence to submit some of my own work for the 2026 Crebo Awards. I feel hopeful about that, and I also feel hopeful for the community radio sector as a whole. I've gone from thinking about it as a fun pastime to considering it a really important step away from doomscrolling fake news on social media and the dominating narratives of global media conglomerates. Community radio is your chance to get your voice and your message out into the world without submitting to commercial demands or formulas. It's where you can learn what's going on where you live and what the people right around you think about the topic of the day. And who knows, you might just find yourself changing your mind or somebody else's. For now, I hope you had an interesting time joining me at the National Community and Campus Radio Conference in Nanaimo, BC 2025. Thank you very much for listening. And hear you out there, on air, somewhere, on your local station, dialed in to your community. The feature you just heard was produced by me, Cornelius Lundsgaard. The background music was produced by Carl Biele and me, and the jazz band you heard was the Kaylee Borsboom Quartet. Thank you to the NCRA for the use of official recordings from the NCRC 43 conference. And many, many thanks, of course, to all of the interviewees. You can find more of my work on soundcloud.com. Search for Radio Cornelius.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
just to start, if you'd be able to just provide like an introduction of yourself and the work you do, as well as your involvement this year with the Coastal Dance Festival.
All right. At Squile Tanoya, Sanakula Kuyansna, Tanachintla, Sahan Ohumeo, A Squahotmishchin. My name is Sanakula Weiss. I'm from the Squamish Nation. Part of my kind of through my life of learning our language has mostly been as an adult speaker through our immersion program offered with the Squamish Nation and SFU. So for myself, only becoming more fluent of a speaker as an adult has been a journey that part of our dance group, we call ourselves Chisha Eichlemund, the mother and her daughter. And so it started just as my mom and I, and then my grandma had passed away a couple of years ago now, but she was able to join us for about 4 or 5 years too. She had battled like cancer and different health issues, but she would be able to still come join us on stage. And as her being a residential school survivor, it was just very difficult. She couldn't speak the language, even though she grew up speaking it until she attended residential school. So for us, and then my children also joined over the years. So for her to see her great-grandchildren, you know, speak our introduction or share the songs and language, that was very special for us. A few of our years performing, especially with Coastal Dance Festival, as being four generations. But of course, yeah, she passed away 2 years ago. But for us, always having this kind of tradition that we've been attending as performers, maybe for about 10 years or more with Coastal Dance Festival. So for us, it's a really special occasion, not only for us to join, but it's also been really wonderful just seeing all the different talent that they bring in as well. It's been really special, both from local, nearby nations. There's even been international indigenous performers, from Maori people to a lot of different groups. So for us, we've been actually able to network and meet other indigenous artists as well. I've got my daughter Lila with me, our newest member. She's 6 months old.
Wow. That's amazing. When I looked into that, I was really curious because, you know, you've been doing this for so long, and I'm wondering for you if like the dynamics or your feelings around it have changed since your own children became introduced to it. Because at a certain point, you were the youngest member, I believe. And now you were sort of taking on that familial, you know, parent role as part of it as well. And I'm wondering how that has sort of changed the experience for you.
Yeah, I think it's been really exciting. For myself, I thought like as like a teenager, as a youth, I didn't really know that kind of like the world might be interested in learning about different parts of Indigenous culture. And that's kind of how my mom just kind of nurtured me and dragged me along into kind of attending the events at the beginning. And it really was cool to just see whether it was to the public or there was ones that we did for school field trips attending at the Museum of Anthropology at UBC, of just really seeing that for us, I sometimes just always thought everybody knew maybe about cultural teachings, or we do other work about like plant walks or sharing about our knowledge, that it kind of really resonated for me to take a step back and see that we hadn't always really had that opportunity to be the teachers ourselves. And so I think whether it is to the public or when we had like performances of like to school groups, for me to really see the importance that we are able to share a bit of who we are through our dancing and singing, and just it also just kind of incorporates storytelling about like local place, about name and languages, that really helps, I think, kind of give that firsthand kind of building relationships with our local or kind of even with the global community as well of people who come and attend the festival. Yeah, so just for me, of kind of seeing over the years of it kind of just being like an exciting like one day kind of, I don't know, more of like a field trip idea, to now it's kind of like we're preparing every year for me, like preparing my children's regalia and making sure that they learn like kind of the importance of like caring for our regalia and like learning the different aspects of weaving our own headbands or parts of what we're going to be wearing, and taking pride of like how we introduce ourselves and how we share like where we come from, that it's a really kind of big part about just having a lot of pride. And not like for me, growing up like in East Vancouver, sometimes it was like, should we not talk about where we're from? Should we have this like it wasn't always like the most big community in my schools, for example, about Indigenous other students. But I think for now, like my children grew up in our Squamish Nation school, so they have more of our close community, I think, than I did growing up. But just really seeing that pride of who we are anywhere, no matter where in our community or out showing the world. Yeah.
It's really cool to just hear about that progression and how I think I saw like that it was in writing that it's your children that are going to be like the first generation of like completely fluent speakers of the language.
Yeah. For when I started taking the language program, my older daughter, Kamea, she's turning 10 this year, but she was 2 at the time. So she was a little bit delayed in her speech. And so it was actually cool to see her. We would always both use American Sign Language, but also we had to kind of create our own Squamish Sign Language during the program, because we really utilize sign language as part of learning it and remembering a lot better. So it was really cool for myself to watch my daughter from 2 years old learning, and like just a really funny moment that we went out to eat breakfast and then everyone was ordering. I think she was maybe 4 or something, but the waiter was like, what would you like to eat? And she's like, I'll get the OOs. And that means eggs in our language. And then I was kind of laughing that to her, it was just like naturally we call eggs OOs, but just being out in the real world at a moment where someone's like, what is she? I was like, oh, she's just calling it eggs in our Squamish language. So for me, especially seeing my grandmother, my grandma always tried to teach me growing up, even though she survived residential school, that she couldn't speak it. What we still acknowledge the elders, if they don't actively speak it out loud, that they still are silent speakers. So whether or not they can carry out a conversation, they still carry that within them. And it's still like they have a lot of knowledge to share, and that kind of worldview where the language is not just a translation from English into our language, but it's a really big part of our worldview, how we see the world, and kind of those important relationships. Those are also part of our language and our culture, and just seeing that those are kind of different perspectives that our language helps us to see the world in.
Absolutely. Language is so much bigger than just characters on a page, right? It's mm-hmm. it's a translation of culture and feeling and connection. Mm-hmm. So I really like how you put that, you know, the sort of like the silent speakers of the language as well, even if like academically it wouldn't be considered.
Yeah, because my grandma was really focused on making sure we knew our genealogy. So like her perspective of understanding how we see like a family, like we might see our cousins as more siblings than like first, second, third cousins. So that worldview that we see our family and community is also part of whether she could name the word for sister or not, like she still knew that relationship of what kind of our worldview would have been with a family tree, for example.
Again, looking into the performances that you've done, one thing I thought was interesting is because it's meant to sort of weave together the different cultural backgrounds of your family, so Squamish, Stolo, Tsimshian, Hawaiian, and Swiss as well. And I guess I'm just curious of like what the process of going about that is, like of what aspects and how that kind of comes together for you.
Yeah, we sometimes have like kind of a short list, I guess, of certain songs that we like to share, but we do sometimes try to focus on kind of the matriarchal or kind of empowering of our women's song. And then for my husband's side, my children are also Lowat Nation, so we'll sometimes share the Women's Warrior song, which is from the Lowat Nation. But sometimes, like we've sang the paddle song, which goes back to kind of recognizing part of our history within Vancouver of the fire in Vancouver. And it was kind of at the more beginning of the colonial contact time, where nuns were doing a translation of hymns into the Squamish language. So it was mostly women at the village of Sahan, which is Lower Lonsdale near Mosquito Creek, St. Paul's Church. And so it was mostly all women there translating our Squamish language and into these songs. And then that's when they saw the fire break out. So it was actually women canoeing over from the Mosquito Creek Marina area, rescuing people in canoes from the fire in the kind of gas town area. So to us, of these kind of hidden stories that not everyone may know the history in Vancouver. And we had shared that, and we actually had somebody say that that was their ancestors who were saved by the Squamish women in that fire. So to us, it was quite moving of hearing the story, but have someone reach out that they were on a different end, I guess, of knowing that history themselves. But some people have never heard of that story too, so it's kind of nice to share different parts of that relationship that Squamish people have with the local communities nearby. Yeah, and then I guess another song we do is the pollinator song. So it's just to bring that kind of our appreciation of Mother Nature and of pollinators and of people who teach about plants, that we always give thanks to the pollinators. That's a more recently composed song.
Yeah. Okay. And that's going to be one of the parts of the performance at the Coastal Dance Festival?
Yes.
Nice. Okay. Yeah. Another thing I had seen is like a big part of your practice is ethnobotany, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, because, and I don't know if I'm, you know, out of my depth here, but I'm wondering if there are, like, to you, any sort of similarities or connections that can be drawn between ethnobotany and the philosophy of it and movement and dance that you've ever considered or thought of?
Yeah, well, I think kind of that slow movement of plants, but they still are very much like live and moving. And one of the interesting kind of parts with cedar trees are kind of our tree of life, that we see the cedar boughs. If you can kind of picture the branches, they come down and then they come back up. And it's kind of like, if you look at like our welcome figures, it's a person with their arms raised up. So it's almost like what we call raising our hands. Or we say kayachin, that it looks like people as Coast Salish culture, we raise our hands kind of in recognition or honor, or like saying thank you or a welcome gesture, that it's also something that we reflect in plants and in nature, of seeing a lot of similarities from plants into the human body, whether it's like the berries with red colors being really good for your heart, for example, or just seeing those connections of plants and nature to people, rather than being separate from nature, I just seeing those similarities between nature and people.
Those were the main questions I'd had regarding the performance. I guess one thing I was curious about was if there are any aspects or lessons or philosophies that you hope people are able to take away from the performance.
I guess for me, I've just really kind of seeing the practice and the art that goes into sharing our songs and our storytelling, and something that kind of resonates with me about especially all of the different languages that we share as well in the festival, of just thinking how our language really reflects who we are and the land. Like often we say, like in our Squamish language, it's really reflecting like our mountain landscape and the ocean. And our kind of worldview is really deeply tied to specific areas within our landscape. So just seeing those different kind of cultural aspects that are really relevant. Yeah, that's mostly to just see that kind of connection that we have to. I don't know if you can hear, but there's like birds outside my window as I'm talking. So it's kind of just, yeah, seeing that kind of change of seasons we're in right now. And just seeing that kind of hopefulness of spring that's coming, of sharing our language.